the Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2019-1642, the State of Ohio versus George Brinkman. For the appellant, Ms. Sanford.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. I would like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal. For today's argument, I would like to focus on parts of the first and second propositions of law, and also the fourth. In the first proposition of law, part one, prosecutorial misconduct occurred when the prosecutor argued contrary to the stipulated facts in the case. The salient points from the record are that the state and defense entered into a stipulation of facts, and before that stipulation was read into the record, which began the state's case in chief, the presiding judge asked defense counsel if they were asking this court, the three-judge panel, to accept the stipulated facts as true, to which both counsel answered in the affirmative. The state did not assert that they had any different opinion on the stipulated facts. And then the stipulation was read into the record and by the prosecutor and filed. At page 147 of the transcript, which is also paragraph 43 of the stipulation itself, the stipulation as read states that after both Mr. and Mrs. John were killed, Mr. Brinkman then took $40 from Mr. John's wallet and then $100 from Mrs. John's wallet. The stipulated facts never says there was a plan to rob the Johns or that they were robbed before they were killed and that was the purpose for the killing. Nothing in the state's presentation of evidence contradicted the stipulated facts. And according to OJI, the Ohio Jury Instructions 5C, a stipulation is one way in which evidence will be introduced at trial. Further, a stipulation is an agreement by both sides that a certain fact is true or that a witness would testify as to certain facts or opinion. And case law also has the same holdings, whereby in Uphouse versus Uphouse, it says, the trier of facts must also accept what is set forth as a statement of settled fact that is undisputed and binding upon the parties in the agreement. This does away with the need for evidence. And in fact, the state says, cites the stipulation in their briefing before this court on page 6 that the taking of money it happened after the killings of the victims. And also,
Counselor, does it matter if the taking of the money happens before or after killing?
In this case, it does, Your Honor, because it changes the narrative of the case. It changes the narrative for sentencing as far as the defense psychologist said that the motive or purpose for this was unknown. And this gives a purpose that was not before the closing argument of the state at the sentencing phase was never before in anything in the record. And not in the stipulation, not in the four witnesses the state presented to the three-judge panel.
So you're saying under the normal circumstances, the definition of the crime, taking of the money wouldn't have mattered before or after. But you're saying in light of the stipulations, it has to show that there was an intent to steal, the intent to rob, which is why the killings happened?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Because the otherwise, as the defense psychologist said, it was more an afterthought. It wasn't that, you know, I have been taking care of the home for these people for 7 to 10 days, and I could have taken everything I want. I'm paraphrasing. Sure. Taken everything I wanted from their home before they got back, but I'm going to wait for them to get home, and I'm going to then kill them so that I can take $140 that I don't even know that they have on them. So it changes the narrative for sentencing. And what happened also in this case is this: the prosecutorial misconduct by stating this, the three-judge panel also adopted that in their findings and said this is what happened. Is that it was an orchestrated plan that when they get home, he was going to meet them at the door with a gun and order them to the room so he could take money from them because he needed money. And again, that belies the evidence in this case. And the prosecutorial misconduct occurs when there are statements that are not proven and it affects the defendant's substantial rights. substantive rights of the defendant, and it did in this case because it changed how the three-judge panel viewed this case for sentencing, and it just changed the whole, like I said, the whole narrative of the case. And also, in reality, the reason for the murders was a question mark. And this is also agreed upon by the state in their brief before this court. On page 6, the state says, the true reason and circumstances surrounding appellant's commission of these horrendous crimes against people who trusted him will never be known. And that was also the defense, you know, presentation was, we don't know. He has a horrible upbringing and some psychological problems, medical problems, but we don't know the real reason. I mean, Dr. Stinson said the reason was that people who he trusted and he cared about were unhappy with how he had taken care of their dog. And that may be, but it certainly was not because he needed to steal $140 from them, so he was going to kill them. And we're asking this court to find that this was prosecutorial misconduct and send this case back, either for a new sentencing hearing, and also because since this was the first time that this theory was presented, was in the closing argument at sentencing, defense counsel had no opportunity to present witnesses to rebut that. It was not stated for opening or closing in the trial phase or opening in the mitigation phase. So they did not know to present anybody to rebut this theory. And again, the plan or purpose is not part of the stipulated facts or the state's presentation of evidence, and it was never proven in the trial. So again, we're asking this court to reverse and remand this case for a new and fair sentencing hearing. If there are no questions anymore on Proposition 1, I'm just going to move to Proposition 2. Proposition of Law Number 2. It also goes to the issue of purpose in this case. What happened, and this is ineffective assistance of counsel for not presenting an expert who had a background in diabetes and the drugs that were used to treat different parts of the diabetes disease. Dr. Stinson testified, and he was the only expert in the mitigation phase who testified. He is a forensic psychologist and a non-practicing attorney. He is not a medical doctor, and he has no expertise in type 1 or any diabetes. He testified to what he could about diabetes, but did not convey the wealth of information about the effects of uncontrolled diabetes and the havoc it can wreak. He brought up the issue of Mr. Brinkman's uncontrolled diabetes, but he didn't know. Mr. Brinkman was diagnosed with diabetes in July of 2015, and he was prescribed gabapentin and Cymbalta, among and also insulin, but those were the two basically that we're focusing on. And then April of 2017, 2 months prior to the crimes, those medications were doubled, the doses. None of this was addressed by the defense at the mitigation phase. It's the effects of his completely uncontrolled diabetes and why these medications needed to be explained. And in fact, one of the judges from the three-judge panel asked Dr. Stinson, question, Dr. Stinson, you indicated that shortly before this incident occurred, his medications, gabapentin and Cymbalta, were doubled in dosage. Is that accurate? Answer, that is accurate. Question, are there any side effects to gabapentin and Cymbalta that we should be aware of? Answer, not that I feel comfortable speaking to. Question, very well. Answer, that goes a little beyond my expertise. Trial counsel were ineffective for not calling an expert who was qualified to testify about any effects of doubling these medications, whether this be a medical doctor, pharmacologist, or both. And again, what effect this could have on Mr. Brinkman's behavior and his mental state. And they could have asked the court for a continuance to present expert testimony to answer the judge's question. The nature of Mr. Brinkman's neuropathy also was not testified to in depth. Neuropathy is, I'm sure everybody knows, is nerve pain. We don't know the extent of that nerve pain, how much he'd been suffering from it, was that also uncontrolled, and what effect did that have on him? Dr. Stinson also wasn't definitive in other parts of his testimony about diabetes. He would say things such as, there are a lot of things going on that are seemingly attributable to the diabetes, such as his weight loss of 64 pounds in a short period of time when he was not trying to lose weight. Erratic insulin levels can have intense effects on one's mood, but again, can have. There need to be an expert who testified, this is what does happen, this is what happened with Mr. Brinkman, and none of that was presented to the three-judge panel. And again, Dr. Stinson, he discussed what he could, but it did not convey the wealth of information. I mean, being a layperson, and I know it's not on the record, I know that. I did a quick internet search, and there is a wealth of information on the, and I know the internet's not a medical doctor, but I'm just saying to lead you to the need for a medical doctor. There's a wealth of information about this uncontrolled type 1 diabetes and where someone has spiking and then plummeting blood sugar levels within hours, which Mr. Brinkman did, which is shown in the Cleveland Clinic records that are admitted, that were admitted at trial and are in the record for this court as Exhibit F. It just shows the need for expert testimony in this case, and that was not presented. And the fact that the judge's question could not be answered is certainly a problem. And we're asking this court to remand to the trial court. And while experts can be presented in post-conviction, of course, we're asking for this court to remand, a limited remand, so that testimony could be presented to answer that question about the effects of doubling gabapentin and Cymbalta a couple months before the crime would have on a person. And that could be done, a limited remand, just for testimony to answer that question so that this court can conduct a meaningful and appropriate analysis. Because otherwise there is an unanswered question out there. Maybe the answer to that is, you know, it's a game changer as far as what it could do to somebody's behavior. And leading up to the crime. I don't have the answer. I'm just saying it could be a game changer. I don't know for sure that it would be. And obviously, Mr. Brinkman was prejudiced by this because, again, his substantial rights were violated because the prosecutor argued this. I'm sorry. His substantial rights were violated because expert testimony needed to be presented to make this a complete picture for the three-judge panel and for this court. In proposition of law number 4, when defense counsel objected to the admission of certain exhibits at the end of the state's case at the trial phase, an improper procedure was utilized by the three-judge panel. Defense counsel objected to state's exhibits 29A through F, 30A through D, and 29J through L. These were autopsy photos and crime scene photos. The presiding judge said that she alone would ask her colleagues to recess for the purpose of deliberations, and she will join them in just a moment once she has determined which exhibits she will be bringing back with her to engage in their deliberations. So she alone determined that all of the state's exhibits were admitted except for 30C. In doing that, she said that she would put that one in the record and her colleagues don't have to necessarily see it.
Was that objected to?
It was not, Your Honor. And the problem, well, I'll answer, I'll go to that right now, is State versus Filiaggi is on point with this argument because that also dealt with revised code 2945.06 and a different part of it, but the same statute. And in the holding for that, this court said that we have consistently required strict compliance with the Ohio statute when reviewing the procedures in capital cases. So we're asking this court to enforce that again in this case because 2945.06 says that when there is a three-judge panel in a capital case, the judges, plural, or a majority of them may decide all questions of fact and law arising upon the trial. The statute does not say that when there is a three-judge panel, one judge alone may make any decisions of fact or law arising upon the trial. It never says a singular judge. And this case, and so again, that violates 2945.06, and it was not strictly complied with, and is error, and this case, and in Filiaggi, it held that the case went back to the point upon when the error occurred. In this case, that would be the end of the state's case the end of the trial phase when they were admitting exhibits. So we need to go back and have the three-judge panel reconstituted to make this determination, because that was error. If there are no other questions, I think I will reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Nemes?
Good morning, Chief Justices. My name is Lisa Nemes, and I am here on behalf of the Stark County Prosecutor representing the state of Ohio. And I just wanted to start off by highlighting a few obvious facts here on a capital conviction where the defendant, Mr. Brinkman, not only waived his right to a jury, but he chose to enter a guilty plea to a three-judge panel. And in his unsworn statement to that panel, Mr. Brinkman himself told the panel that any aggravating circumstances here far outweigh the mitigating factors. And he himself stated that anything less than a sentence of death would not be justice. Starting in response to the comments on Proposition of Law 1, there were no statements made here that actually contravened the stipulated facts in the record. The parties did enter a lengthy stipulation of facts, but that's exactly what they are. They're the facts that the parties agree to. It's not the entire universe of facts that are relevant in this case. Both the state and the defense presented additional exhibits, presented witnesses, and there's nothing in the statement of facts that would preclude the state from arguing its theory based on those facts, which is that Mr. Brinkman had a plan to deprive the Johns of money and that he used the weapon that he found in their house, held them at gunpoint, and took the money.
What facts support that, that he planned to rob them?
Well, I think his own statement in his confession is that he needed money to get out of town. He knew that he had to go and he wanted to take money with him. And while it might not have been a full...
And to get out of town for what reason?
Sequences of events that had led up to that point in time, recent events that had happened that caused Mr. Brinkman to feel that he needed to leave town, and he was in a situation where he couldn't easily do that with telling people that he needed to leave or obviously asking the Brinkmans.
So things that happened prior to Joneses, the
yes.
couple returning home.
Yes, the things that the Johns were not aware of, and that it wouldn't have been something that Mr. Brinkman would have been able to explain to them or ask them to borrow money, explain why he was leaving town. He needed to get out quickly, and he might not have had the most careful plan. It might not have been planned out far in advance, but he knew when he put put the bullets into the clip and loaded the clip into the weapon that there was a possibility he was going to use it at that point, and he ended up doing that once the Johns returned home.
So do you know whether he took the money before he shot them or after?
In Mr. Brinkman's own words, he stated that he took the money out of the wallet and out of the purse after he killed them. But this is really a distinction without any difference here, because he admits also in his confession that he took the purse and took the wallet from them before he did that. He was already in possession of the purse and in possession of the wallet before he killed them. He stated in the portion of the record, it's his interview exhibit 34, about approximately 20 minutes to 23 minutes when he's describing the sequence of events, he realized that Jean had his wallet in his hand and that Bobby had her purse when he was corralling them up the stairs and into a bedroom at gunpoint. And he instructed Bobby at that point that she was to empty their pockets. He described Jean taking a knife out of his pocket, tossing it on the bed, and Mr. Brinkman pushing that away from him so that he didn't have access to it.
Was there evidence of that? Was that knife found?
I believe the knife was found on the ground or underneath a dresser at some point, which is where he described throwing it. He took their phones from them at that point, made sure they didn't have access to those. And so the wallet and the purse containing amount of money that may not have been known to him at the time, he took those from him from the Johns before he killed them, and then admitted that after he did that, he took the money, the $40 from Jean's wallet, the $100 from Bobby's purse, because he needed to get out of town and he needed money to do so. So any slight misstatement that the prosecutor might have made in saying that the money was taken from the person's wallet before he killed them is really irrelevant here, and it certainly doesn't amount to prosecutorial misconduct, especially when it wasn't objected to during the trial. And basically the whole portion of the argument here, the first proposition of law discussing the nature and circumstances of the offense, the only thing that the state did here was present their theory of the evidence. It was nothing beyond the stipulated evidence, the exhibits that came in, and the testimony that was presented. And the state, or the defense, acknowledged the same. In response to the state's closing arguments, trial counsel said that the inferences drawn by the state are not reasonable from the evidence. She disagreed with the presentation of this theory and presented the defense's own theory that this was an impulsive act on Mr. Brinkman's part and that he didn't mean to do any of this. And it was up for the judges to determine at that point which theory was more plausible, which theory they believed based on the evidence.
Well, counsel, what about the lack of an expert to testify? If I recall, the impulsiveness and et cetera is linked to his instability with his health, correct?
Correct. And Dr. Stinson did discuss his impulsive behavior. He did not rule out the possibility that despite his proclivity for impulsive actions that Mr. Brinkman had been displaying in the days leading up to committing these offenses, that was possible. But he didn't rule out that it was something he intended to do. The fact that he may have done it impulsively certainly doesn't mean that he couldn't have done it with some kind of a plan.
Well, okay, but the fact that the more information was needed about the condition of his uncontrolled diabetes, the medication that he was taking, and the effect that effect would have on him,
Sure. There simply isn't any information in the record to determine whether an expert would have opined that this had any bearing on his actions that day.
How would that, get into the record? I forget the name of the doctor that was testifying.
Dr. Stinson.
Okay. He didn't say, I can't answer that. You really need to bring in an expert to answer these questions. Now, that would have obviously set up the red flag that something, was not done and should have been done by the defense, but we don't have that.
No, and he didn't indicate it was anything he believed should have been explored.
But he did have the expertise to determine that.
Correct, and as the appellant has noted in their own brief, the proper procedure here is a petition for post-conviction relief. That's the appropriate time to bring that up. They've even cited cases acknowledging that, and essentially what they're asking this court to do is to change that procedure and bypass the opportunity that they have to raise those issues in a post-conviction petition and create a new procedure where this court would remand it for the court to determine those issues. And it's just simply not a necessary procedure, but that's exactly what the post-conviction process is there for. So, at that point in time, they can inquire of experts whether or not there would be, whether it would have any bearing on the offenses here, but there's no reason to believe that the gabapentin or the Cymbalta that Mr. Brinkman was taking had an effect here. Nothing in this record would tell us that.
Don't you have to sort of analyze that in the framework of ineffective assistance, though?
Well, yes, and I think that's the issue, that it's premature. This is kind of a wrong court, wrong time issue to raise that on direct appeal. And, even the cases that they cited to in their own brief, State v. Carter and State v. Madrigal, acknowledging issues involving the denial of expert assistance must be raised in post-conviction, not direct appeal, due to the incompleteness of the record on direct appeal. So, they can go back to the court and say these should have been brought up at this time and they weren't, and make that argument and get an evidentiary hearing at that point.
But if he doesn't raise it on appeal, doesn't he risk it being res judicata later because he could have raised it?
Well, and it can
unless there's new evidence.
And I think that would be the new evidence, because they would be seeking an expert report that would say that this had some bearing here. But I also think that to say that it's truly ineffective assistance of counsel, there would have to be some reason to point to say that the counsel knew that there was something to this medication, that there, you know, the fact that he was taking these two medicines and that his dosage had been increased, and the fact that he had diabetes had some bearing here, because if it doesn't, then it doesn't, he wasn't prejudiced by him. It's not going to affect the outcome. If there would be no expert that would state that this was a significant factor, it doesn't change any of the, it just doesn't change the outcome of this case.
If it's an unanswered question, though, I think maybe you said it wasn't relevant. I think that went to the prosecutor's statements, but if it's an unanswered question and it seems in the record there's an indication that it should have been answered, what do we do?
Well, one of the judges one of the panel members just simply asked if he knew about it, and he said if he knew, you know, if he could explain anything about the Cymbalta and the gabapentin, and he indicated that it was not within his realm of expertise. But again, he certainly didn't state that, you know, I think this is an issue that should have been explored. It needed to be explored. I have, you know, there's some reason to believe that this had an influence on the crime that he
But he
committed.
Wasn't asked that question, correct?
No. He was not asked directly asked whether this had any bearing on the actions that Mr. Brinkman admittedly committed here.
Thank you.
Counselor, in proposition of law number 3, dealing with the photographs of the crime scene and the autopsy report, it's true that Mr. Brinkman did agree to the admissibility of all the evidence and confessed, et cetera. So the photos really, as you say, would not affect the outcome of the guilty, of finding of guilt, right? What was the purpose of them at all? I know we have a panel here, but.
Correct. Most of these exhibits, it appears that they were stipulated to, and when they went to enter, admit the exhibits, the stipulated exhibits into the record, at that point the prosecutor, the defense raised an objection to some of them as being overly gruesome. And it was obvious that the crime scene photographs were discussed throughout. And those were relied on to some extent to see what had happened in the room where the Johns were murdered. And as far as the
but didn't Mr. Brinkman say what had happened?
And he did admit his, you know, he did give his version, which didn't explain some discrepancies, and one of those being a door handle that was missing. He couldn't provide an adequate explanation.
But I mean, with regard to the pictures of the victims. The gunshot, the blood.
Yeah, the crime scene photographs, as Judge Hartnett indicated, are not particularly gruesome. Most of the
the pictures of the bodies, pictures of
the
autopsies, pictures of them when they were killed and lying in blood, those sort of things. What purpose did they serve for this case?
These were admitted during the trial phase, and it doesn't appear, I guess, the purpose at that time, it was thought maybe that they were going to, if there was a question as to the sequence of who was shot when, how many bullets into each victim. Again, there was an issue of timing about whether the first bullet shot was Mr. John's hip.
But again, how was any of that relevant to this case where he admitted everything?
It doesn't appear that even though they admitted them into evidence, that the autopsy photos were something that the court considered. It wasn't discussed during closing arguments. It wasn't discussed during the mitigation phase, and it certainly wasn't discussed in the panel's decision on the sentencing entry. So at the time they were admitted during the trial phase, perhaps it was thought that they would have some bearing on some issue. And it turned out that, you know, as it played out through the proceedings, they didn't come into play, but it also wasn't considered. So now we have just a disagreement about how allegedly gruesome they were, and Judge Hartnett's opinion as to whether that substantially outweighed any prejudicial value.
Right. And in cases like this, and clearly the prejudicial value is virtually non-existent based on his confession, but I guess I'm just always concerned about the need for these type of pictures, particularly when we have a jury that's involved, when there is an admission of guilt, when there is a stipulation to what happened, when there is the coroner and the medical examiner's report of everything. I mean, I guess at this stage in life, it's probably just pro forma that the state will just always do this. But in instances, as opposed to when there's some question one of guilt, when there's some question of the exact crime that was committed, but when there's no question here, isn't it just kind of cumulative?
I don't disagree that it could be construed that way, especially if it was a jury scenario. But because we have a three-judge panel here, I think that plays out a little differently.
It certainly does for effect and impact and shock when you have judges. But from a legal standpoint, even more so, they aren't needed when you have a three-judge panel, when they have a confession before them and when the state and when there's stipulation. So I guess, you know, it's just... I was just wondering if there is a time when those sort of photos are pulled back as unnecessary.
And maybe they, you know, to the extent that they don't appear to have been used or considered in any way in this case, you know, perhaps they were unnecessary, but it just doesn't appear that the judge necessarily abused her discretion in letting them in. I don't think that's been established.
Ms. Nemes? Isn't it probable, though, that those photos are also used in as supportive evidence for the aggravating factors for the penalty phase of the trial, correct?
I think if it was a jury that we could say that it's possible that they were influenced by that, but there's no indication on the record here that the judges considered those photos, that they reviewed or discussed those photos, because it wasn't brought up in the mitigation phase.
Well, except they had to deliberate at some point and take all the evidence with them to deliberate. And let me ask you, was it appropriate for one judge to make the determination of the admissibility of those photos and to choose which photos that they would actually consider as evidence for either phase of the trial?
Yeah, I think it's really important here to point out the fact that in addition to the statute not requiring procedure...
Didn't it say plural?
It says the judges or a majority of them may decide all questions of law and fact arising upon the trial, but it doesn't mandate that all procedural rulings and evidentiary rulings are necessarily made by the entire panel.
But isn't admissibility a question of fact?
But the judge has some discretion here, so it's a discretionary issue.
So if it's a panel of three judges, it has to be a majority of two, a judge or the judges or a majority of the panel. So it has to at least be two judges, not one, doesn't it?
And it's permissive here. It says that the judges or a majority of them may decide. And I believe that the purpose of the statute, or the way that it's phrased, that this goes to decisions like factual conclusions of law, and that this wouldn't apply to an evidentiary ruling. And when we're talking about somebody maybe being exposed to unnecessarily gruesome photos, I don't think that we'd want the entire panel of judges to look at them when one judge might conclude that this is something like that shouldn't, like Exhibit 30C, which Judge Hartnett decided to exclude, that you don't want the entire panel exposed to those photos. At that point, they've already seen them, so it's almost irrelevant whether they go back into deliberations with the judges. They've reviewed them.
I don't think that's what the statute says, and I think that's what the judges have to follow.
It doesn't speak exactly to the procedural rulings, and it would seem that no one objected to this, because this is raised under the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, they would need to establish that if they had made that objection, that it would have been sustained. And I don't think that there's any reason to believe at this point that the judge would have agreed with their interpretation of the statute.
I think it would have been that it could have had an effect on the outcome of the trial. And in this case, with it being a death penalty trial, there were the two phases. We knew that the guilt was a given, but the question of the punishment was something that I think would need the analysis to answer that question.
I don't agree that it could affect during deliberations, but I don't believe that we should, we're going to presume that the three panel, the judges of the panel are able to look at this and not be unduly influenced by anything that's particularly gruesome. That's one of the things that we can trust the judges to do. With a jury, we don't have that kind of assurance. But again, as far as speculating as to whether there could have been any prejudice here or whether he could have been harmed by the inclusion of some of these photos, where there may be some debate as to whether or not they were even as gruesome as appellant is asserting that they are on appeal, because the judges didn't consider the nature of how the bodies were left. That was the scene, the evidence of how they were shot, where they were shot, wasn't as relevant to the panel as the fact that he waited until they got home when he could have just taken things from them and avoided this altogether. It doesn't appear that they factored the number of times they were hit or anything that was depicted in those photos. There's just no indication that it did sway their decision.
Wasn't there some language about how the bodies were found by their son?
Yes.
Right? And so, I mean, these pictures would depict where the bodies were in the bedroom when their son, you know, a day later, finds them.
Yes, absolutely. The crime scene photos were, I don't think there's any dispute that those ones were very relevant for a number of purposes, and that they were not particularly gruesome. So I think the only issue would be limited to the autopsy photos, which just there's no indication that those were that those unfairly prejudiced the judges in their decision. And again, the whole idea that if counsel had, they did not object to the procedure where just Judge Hartnett was making the decision as presiding judge, and if they had, there's no indication that would have been successful, that there's no precedent that they would have been citing to inform the court that it was required to proceed that way. It'd just be a matter of interpreting that statute and interpreting how far that goes as to what exactly the panel needs to involve all of the judges on before they make a decision. So
regarding the statute that requires that the rules be strictly followed, how do you square that with harmless error? Because I think you're either saying you don't think that statute applies about deciding which evidence comes in terms of the photos, or that if it was done improperly, it could be harmless error. But what about the strict compliance requirement with the procedures because it's a death penalty case?
That comes into back to the interpretation of the statute and having to determine that it be required that more than one judge weigh in on this decision. And because the statute doesn't specifically speak to that in terms of evidentiary or procedural ruling, I would suggest that the procedural, there's been compliance here, that there's been strict compliance if it's not mandated. If it is mandated, if this court were to conclude that it was mandated, I think that's a different analysis because it wasn't raised below. It's ineffective assistance argument I don't believe can prevail, and so we'd be looking at a plain error review of that, and I don't believe that there's been any prejudice to the defendant because of that.
Thank you.
The majority of the additional propositions of law are raised to some extent throughout the ineffective assistance of counsel argument. And one of the things I just wanted to point to, something I've already raised, is that the majority of these are based on a failure to object. And because a failure to object on its own can't be ineffective assistance of counsel, and it's not been demonstrated that the majority of these have arguments could have had any merit, or that there would have been a likelihood that the court would have granted a motion or objection if it had been sustained an objection if it had been made. There's no basis for assigning ineffective assistance of counsel on those grounds. And unless there are any additional questions that the court has on any of the propositions of law, I would just ask that the court affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
Thank you. I would actually like to start in the reverse order, if I may, with Proposition 4. In Filiaggi, there also was no objection by counsel. And this, that's when this court said strict compliance is necessary and sent it back for the three-judge panel to make the decision. It was on the non-capital charges in the case. And again, so there was no objection there either. And it was, but strict compliance was required, or is required. I'm sorry.
Counsel, the photographs that you're taking issue with, the admission and the process by which they were gathered and went back to the room to be viewed by the judges, you say that all three judges should have made that decision.
All three or a majority. The statute says the judges.
Well, all three had to look at it in order to get the majority.
Yes.
Okay, so they're subjecting themselves to the pictures, and then, you know, they're exposed to them. They know what they are seeing, and at that point, in essence, you're asking all three to, you know, if they don't want to bring them back to the evidence room, forget what you've seen, you know, they're not going to be back in the evidence room for you to take a look at. And that seems a little incongruous to have that kind of a process. And so the permissive nature of just having the presiding judge make that decision is probably more sensible, don't you agree?
No, Your Honor, I don't, because also the pictures that came in, because the presiding judge only excluded one of the pictures. And so, again, all the judges saw all but the one picture as it is. But then those were admitted in the sentencing phase, and those were considered for sentencing in this case also.
But they weren't referred to by the three-judge panel.
Right, but I think we assume that they reviewed everything in coming to the determination of at the trial phase and the sentencing
phase. Their weight,
phase.
The weight of their consideration, how they played, what factor. I mean, there is an allegation that the bodies left in the bedroom the way they were, and then the son, you know, coming there, that's a aggravating a factor.
Yes.
Something to consider. I mean, those are pictures that allow the judges to see that bedroom scenario.
But I think that especially with judges, I mean, judges see this kind of, I mean, I don't want to say all the time, but they see this evidence and they're able to not factor that in to the calculus, but just go by
Ms. Sanford, if I'm a trial judge in a capital case and I have a jury, it's my job to review all of the photographs that the state wants introduced into evidence, listen to the objections of the defense counsel, of ones they don't want into the evidence, make the decision, and only what I decide is admitted goes back to the jury. Now, when it comes time for a final decision of the jury on sentencing, the judge, if the jury recommends death, the judge makes the final decision, but the judge has seen all of the photographs. Is there any appreciable difference between that and the three judges seeing all the photographs and deciding what is needed as admitted in the record?
No, because I think when it comes back to the trial judge after the jury makes their recommendation, it's the oath. I mean, you're going to review the exhibits that you allowed in. And you may have seen other ones, that is true, but you're held to, the case law says that, you know, you only will consider or weigh what it is that you've admitted and not the others that you excluded.
Thank you.
Also, though, with Proposition 4, like I said, there was no objection filiage, and again, they were admitted at sentencing, so they came in, and appellant would prefer that all three judges or a majority, you know, are the ones who decide which exhibits come in.
And understandably, that's a preference, but again, is it permissive, as counsel, the prosecutor stated? Is the May language more permissive than mandatory?
I believe strict compliance is that either three judges or two of the three will determine which exhibits come in from the statute. It says the judges or a majority of them. So if it doesn't have to be three, it could be two, but it must be at least two of the judges who decide which ones come in. And that didn't happen in this case. And it seems as though maybe
the presiding judge knew that by the time they got to sentencing, because when the state admitted, sought to admit all their exhibits from trial, the trial phase into sentencing, she did say, I don't remember the language, but conferred with the other two judges about, do you agree with all this being admitted into the sentencing phase? And they said yes. So she knew at that point to ask the other two judges. So I don't know if something happened between the trial phase and then, but she did it correctly then, just not the first time, at the end of the trial phase. The prosecutor brought up with Proposition 1 about how you can argue other than what's in the stipulated facts, but you can't argue contrary. And that's what the state did in this case, because the stipulation says that the robbery occurred after the murders. And then the prosecutor, again, for the first time in closing at sentencing, says, no, the robbery occurred first. He took money.
But if he says, I took their purse, I took the wallet, you know, before I shot them, okay, does it matter what the contents of those objects were? He took them before he shot them.
What I heard from the statement Mr. Brinkman made was that he told them to Mrs. John to put her purse on the bed and Mr. John to put his wallet somewhere. So he knew they had a wallet and a purse, if that's what you're saying.
He deprived them of possession of their objects, their wallet, their purse, their cell phones, right? He took all that from them.
Yes.
They could not use those. He deprived them of those.
Right.
Okay. And he had a gun when he did that.
Yes.
Okay. Does it matter what was in that purse or their wallet at the time?
Does it matter?
I mean, the fact that he opened it up afterwards and found money in it, okay, you know, that was probably his intent to get money. Or whatever was in the contents. Otherwise, why would he have instructed them what to do with those objects?
I thought he instructed them to do that because he wanted everything else off. He just wanted the two of them themselves on the bed and just everything else. I mean, cell phone, knife, you know, purse, wallet, just, you know, off the bed. I don't know why exactly he asked, you know, for all that to be done. But it doesn't, from my understanding also, though, or another interpretation of this could be that he realized once he'd killed them, that's when he realized, you know, he realized that he wanted to get out of town.
I thought he wanted to get out of town beforehand because there were things that had happened that, you know, directed him that he needed to get out of town.
I don't remember anything in the record for this case that says that. I mean, he was at their house for 7 to 10 days, and he didn't leave town. And he, you know, took care of the dog, mowed the yard, power washed the deck and the furniture and all that.
Right.
So, I mean, if he really needed to get out of town, he could have gotten out of town before that, before the 7 and 10 days staying at their house. So I didn't get from the record that he had a plan all along to get out of town. But what I'm saying is my interpretation from his statement, what could have been that, you know, I've just committed, look at what I've just done. I need to get out of here. And I'm going to see now if there's any money here. Because Mrs. John had already given him, he said, $100 for gas for while he was taking care of the dog during the week. And so that was my understanding from his statement, or at least my interpretation was it happened at that time. And it wasn't that, oh, I'm going to do all this stuff, you know, while they're away, and then, oh, when they get home, then I'm going to, you know, have a gun, I'm going to order them in here and take money, and this is how I'm going to do it. We know that the Johns had a gun and a lawnmower. He could have sold those for probably more than $140 before they got back. So saying that he was going to rob them when they got back really...
Well, but he didn't know how much money they might have in their wallet, in their possession,
true.
Once they return.
True, that is true.
And the gun, is there any question that the gun used belonged to Mr. Johns?
I don't have any reason to dispute that. I don't have anything from the record to dispute that.
And so, well, we don't know whether he knew about that gun ahead of time, whether he found it while he was there house sitting, but we do know by the time the Johns arrived home, he had it in his possession and it was armed and loaded.
He said he'd been fiddling around with the gun. He loaded, he put a clip in. He didn't know there was a round in the chamber, and that he realized, oh, I probably shouldn't have had the gun out, so he set it down when he went out to greet them to bring in their luggage, is my recollection from the record. So yes, he did. I mean, he had the gun. He knew he placed it somewhere. It wasn't on his person when he greeted them, from his statement and the stipulation.
And then all of this just fell apart kind of spontaneously, according to his testimony.
According to Dr. Stinson, that he had all the risk factors and everything else. And again, the unanswered question about the diabetes, we don't know how that played in. But for whatever reason, yeah, that him being criticized for not taking good care of the dog, et cetera. And Dr. Stinson said that he operated at there was a baseline, and he was just barely above that. So anything could take him over that, where he would overreact or, you know, and act in the way that he did.
Counsel, I want to turn to a different subject. We have an independent review obligation, right?
Yes.
Do I care that there was a stipulation that the crime was horrendous? And do I care or take into account his unsworn statement about the death penalty and all that? Do I ignore all that?
I do not believe that you do.
So if somebody says, well, probably should impose the death penalty, should I take that into account?
I'm sorry, if someone says you shouldn't impose...
Yeah, his unsworn statement was kind of...
Right.
Yeah.
His statement saying the aggravators outweigh the mitigators and I deserve death.
Do I ignore that or take that into account?
I mean, I think you take it into account of someone who has just been convicted and, you know, is up for the death penalty. He has such remorse. I believe the panel took it as remorse, showing remorse as well.
But there was a stipulation that it was a horrendous crime.
Yes.
Do I care about that? Do I take that into account?
I think you take everything into account, everything in the stipulation into account.
Right, but if I'm correct, what Justice Fischer is saying, do you use the fact that he admits that as a mitigating factor, that he recognizes that? Is that something that we take into consideration?
That it's a horrendous crime, or that he deserves the death penalty?
All of it. If he says it's a horrendous crime, I deserve the death penalty, this was atrocious, are those things we say, oh, that's good, he recognizes it, that should be a mitigating factor?
Well, the panel, it's an unsworn statement. Obviously, he's not under oath. And he still feels terrible, obviously, you know, about this. And obviously, somebody can change their how they think over time. Someone who is just sentenced to death or has just committed these crimes, I have no idea what they're thinking.
So you're saying yes, I guess, as opposed to someone who doesn't say anything or just like, yeah, I did it, they had it coming to them, or have a cavalier attitude about taking the life of two people.
I think it does show great remorse on his part. And again, I believe in his unsworn, he talks about, you know, how wonderful the Johns were. And there's not everything in the record shows, I mean, he cared about them, and he wanted to take good care of their home while they were away. He'd done it before. He was asked to come back and do it again. They trusted him, and I don't think he ever saw this coming. I know the state disputes that, but I don't believe that the record shows there was an orchestrated plan.
Counsel,
to kill
how much time elapsed between when he committed the crime and when he was making this unsworn statement?
Well, he committed the crimes were committed on June 11th, and his unsworn statement was, the trial was a couple years later.
Okay, was he stabilized on his medications during that entire time?
The prison records show, I mean, he was on insulin and he was on gabapentin. His numbers were still, his blood sugar numbers were still spiking and plummeting during that time. They considered him more stable. Yes, that is true.
Was he taking any psychotropic medications that, you know, stabilizes mental? He had, was it PTSD and depression?
Depression and possibly borderline personality.
Okay, and the Cymbalta was directed towards
a mental health, and the gabapentin would be a pain reliever, but Cymbalta can be as well. So he needed something in addition to that. And what was he on?
I believe he was on Lyrica at some point. I think he was on antidepressant also.
Okay, the Lyrica and the gabapentin, the same thing.
Okay. I'm sorry, I thought gabapentin and Neurontin were the same thing. Sorry.
No. Anyway, okay. My question is, was he stabilized in his diabetes so he was cogent and speaking, I guess, as effectively and with the best mental capacity that he had at the trial?
Yes, I believe that he was.
Okay.
Yes. Not being a doctor and being able to review the medications he was on from that standpoint, having that knowledge, which also Dr. Stinson didn't have. So again, that way would have been nice to have a medical doctor review that as well prior to the start of trial, which never happened in this case.
Okay.
I see that.
He was incarcerated.
Sorry?
He was incarcerated prior to and during the trial, so whatever medical attention he was getting was probably through the county jail there, correct?
Yes. Yes, and he was only in Stark County, I believe, for, was it 1 year? So 1 year of that time would have been at the Stark County Jail. Yes. And I, again, not being trained in that, and not being trained in medicine, I don't know if he was on the appropriate doses or how that works.
Thank you.
Don't know.
Thank you. You've used your time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.